As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Now, perfect guest, Jonathan Golub, Credit Suisse Chief U.S. Equity Strategist, joins us on the year ahead. John, fantastic to catch up with you again, sir. 2021 and the return to normal. The title of your research, sir. What is normal these days?
Well, first of all, we're trying to really look out and push the horizon and say, you know, what does 22 look like? And the reason we're focused on that is if we're trying to forecast where markets are at the end of 21, it's going to be based on the way the world looks at the end of 21, peering into 2022. And at that point in time, you're looking at not an economy that's bouncing off the bottom with this discussion of cyclicals and low quality stocks. You're looking at an economy that's probably growing GDP in the low to mid threes, which will be very good, but actually slowing because we're moving towards a mid-cycle kind of environment already. Interest rates will probably be a little bit higher, but not dramatically higher. The surprise will be the unemployment rate is expected based on Bloomberg surveys. The unemployment rate will be, you know, moving towards 5%, towards full employment, because we're going to find that the people who've been unemployed are going to be the easiest to put back to work.
John, let me go to what you do best. And folks, Golub's reports are exceptionally dense with ratios and margins and all that. Tiffany, just as one example, hammered by this pandemic, just came out with a 200 beep margin expansion. I don't know if they go up or down today. I don't care. John Golub, is that the surprise of next year, that corporations adapt and margins are solid or even elevate?
Yeah, Tom. I mean, if you actually look historically, and I know we're getting really in the weeds, the earnings improvement is always on the margin line. It's revenues will be up, a bit. This is obviously a lousy year. Revenues will be back, 5% or something like that. But if we're expecting something closer to 20% earnings growth, you're going to get there on the margin line. And I don't know if that's a surprise. It's pretty much what typically happens.
Jonathan, I know that one of your sectors that you like is financials. And we've seen a yield curve that's tried to steepen and failed again and again in some sort of sustained way. What's underpinning your financials call? And John Farrow has raised this point several times. How much does it hinge on the steepening of that yield curve?
Well, I think there's a half dozen things that are really working here. First of all, the banks have reserved for substantial losses. So they're in very good situation with their regulators. Secondly, the regulators have forced them to cut back on dividends and buybacks, and that's most likely going to get released in the second quarter, because my third point is that the loan losses are not getting worse and they've over-reserved. So you're going to start to see probably around the second quarter, maybe the third quarter, that they're going to be giving more money back to shareholders. And that's going to appear to be a bit of a surprise. From a valuation perspective, relative to, you know, the way they normally trade, the two cheapest sectors are financials and healthcare. So you have all of those things working for you, even if you didn't get any yield curve steepness. Now, if you don't have at least a flat to steeper yield curve, the trade's not going to work. But even 15 basis points of steepening over the next 12 months, along with those other positives, is probably all you need for it to be a leading sector.
John, we've got to talk about the regulatory backdrop as well. So much discussions about Chair Yellen, monetary policy, fiscal policy. The last act of the Fed under Chair Yellen wasn't a monetary policy decision. It was a decision to stick the boot in to Wells Fargo. John, do you have a call for next year, your base case on regulation around this administration?
You know, it's a good question, and we need to hear more from regulators. I will tell you the question that we're getting about Janet Yellen in the Treasury role is, you know, what is she going to do to monetary policy, and is she going to do more QE? And the questions are kind of bizarre because they're really questions as if she was being appointed to another term as Fed chair, not as Treasury secretary. Her role is going to be different. I would assume that there's going to be some real respect for her thinking on those issues, given the role she's been in. But she doesn't control that, and she's going to. So it'll be very interesting to see which levers she looks to push.
John, what is your call on the banks, on the financials?
Yeah, we're overweight financials. We have a very strange sector call, or at least historically strange. We think that next year is going to end up being another tech and growth year. So we're overweight what we call tech plus, but we're also overweight financials. And it's that we think the financials are in a much healthier position, or a much more advantageous position, as compared to energy, materials, industrials, traditional cyclicals that do really well as the economy is reaccelerating. We think banks are going to do better because, as I mentioned before, yield curve likely steeper, loan losses coming in less, regulatory backdrop we think will be reasonable.
John, great to catch up with you, sir. Really enjoying the research through the year, and especially over the last couple of weeks. Enjoy Thanksgiving if we don't catch up. Jonathan Golub there of Credit Suisse. Thank you, sir.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Now, on New York State as a proxy for America. And why do I say that? Well, it's not about, say, Tiffany and earnings today at Fifth Avenue and 57th Street. It's maybe south of Buffalo, New York, to Yorkville and over to Warsaw. In the fields of Western New York, the pandemic is out of control. Kathy Hochul knows his territory cold with Governor Cuomo. She is a lieutenant governor and has been a wonderful voice for us over the recent weeks. Kathy, the Buffalo News has my article of the day on the pandemic, and it's real simple. It's not about the beds. It's about the staff in hospitals. How critical is hospital staffing in the Empire State?
Well, Tom, thank you for having me back on the show again. That is absolutely the situation we find ourselves in. I was just on a control room call with all the leaders of our hospitals, as well as with the leadership of our elected officials throughout Western New York. We can put together as many beds as necessary. We can fill a convention center. We have plenty of PPE. The governor insisted that every hospital have a 3-month supply of PPE before they could reopen. Here's the situation. We don't have people coming from all over the country to help save New York City and New York State like we did in the spring. We had 30,000 healthcare workers answer Governor Cuomo's call for help at our darkest hour. We don't have that anymore. In fact, the people we have now, they're exhausted. They're burned out. They're getting sick themselves. And they're pleading nonstop, saying, well, do this, please, people, follow for our own health. And so it is going to be a crisis situation if the numbers continue on the path they're on. Without a doubt.
And Lieutenant Governor, to bring this back to Fifth Avenue, David Reich of Mount Sinai saying much the same thing the other day. Okay, you've got a Biden administration. There's change in the wind as well. But you still need, as a Democrat, to deal with a Republican Senate, ex the Georgia vote that I know is coming up. Do you see any greater of a chance now of you getting the aid you, the MTA, the governor need sooner?
Well, the situation is that there are Republican senators who represent states that are going through hell right now. I mean, representatives from North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, Idaho, they were not willing partners with us in the spring when it was mostly the northeastern states and California that were being hardest hit. Remember Mitch McConnell said no bailout for the blue states? Well, my friend, they are now red, white, and blue states. So it's all over America. And I hope that that will shock the consciousness of the senators as they listen to their Republican governors who are desperate in need of money as well to help compensate them for loss in revenue, for the extraordinary costs they're incurring, having to pay so much for extra overtime and helping, you know, all the healthcare workers that need to be paid. And so there's, I think that that could create a different dynamic than we've seen before. I hope it does. It should. And Governor Cuomo, I know, has a very strong relationship with President-elect Biden, as I do from my time in Congress. So we know that we'll get a good ear out of the White House, certainly the House of Representatives, and the Senate will look really bad, and they have elections coming, yes, in 2 years again already, and they need to be cognizant of that. This is their time to stand up for their country and their states, and they need to do it by making sure that there's money for not just state and local governments, but we need PPP again. We have businesses that are being re-shut down after reopening all across our state, all across the country, and these poor businesses cannot survive without federal assistance.
Kathy, in the meantime, before we get any fiscal support, we are going to probably be getting a vaccine, possibly in the next couple of weeks with emergency authorization. What's the plan? Who gets it first in New York? How quickly will it get rolled out?
I think your last question is the most important. I hope we, you know, to reverse your question, I do hope we get a stimulus plan before the vaccine is widely available. We don't expect it most there to be mass inoculation of New Yorkers until 6 months from now. We will start with the healthcare workers, the frontline workers, those who are vulnerable, the senior citizens, communities of color that are having infection rates at much higher than the national average for whites. The communities of color, black and brown, are really being harder hit. So we have a plan that Governor Cuomo and our team have been working on literally since July. We have a Nobel Prize winner heading up our efforts to ensure the safety of the vaccine, along with what's going on at the federal government. But we will get it out to New Yorkers as soon as humanly possible, the second it's available. In fact, the governor has said we'll have the most robust distribution plan in America. That all being said, this is not the save-all. This does not allow you to go around without a mask and say, well, I'll get a vaccine, I'll be fine. That vaccine is not going to be widely available for months. And so we're going to have to adapt to it. And we'll need that money before that's available.
So, Lieutenant Governor, you've got a plan that you've come up with for the state of New York. Can you walk me through whether there is a plan at a federal level and what the discussions between the state of New York and the federal government actually look like right now?
Well, yesterday, the governor asked me to participate in a call with the White House, so with other governors, and there was a very aggressive plan. We talked about our role in that in terms of the distribution, and they are working on this closely. So we are in partnership with them. We have to be. You know, we're not going to, just because it's still the Trump administration, not work with them. Of course we're going to work with them. It's great to know that they're working aggressively. But we also know that as soon as Joe Biden takes over January 20th, I anticipate that there'll be an understanding that the Trump plan as it stands now is focused on, yes, they've identified populations that should get it first, but also their plan does not take into consideration the fact that most people do not have a pharmacy or a doctor readily available to them. Look at our most densely populated urban areas. There's not a CVS, a Rite Aid, or a Walgreens on every corner. You see that in wealthier suburbs. We don't have that in rural areas. So to expect that people are going to be able to go to a doctor easily and also be able to go to a pharmacy to get it is merely unrealistic. So in New York, we're going to make sure that we engage the churches, the community centers, the senior housing, the congregate setting sites. So we're going to be even drill even deeper down into the distribution that is being offered by the federal government. But our, as I mentioned, our communication was as recently as 24 hours ago. So it's ongoing.
Kathy, we appreciate the update. Thank you. Kathy Hochul there, New York's Lieutenant Governor.
Right now, what we've tried to do is people our conversations from yesterday afternoon with not only people that know Janet Yellen, have worked with Janet Yellen, but understand the theories and bringing the theories over to policy. No one has done the movement of theory over to policy like Frederick Mishkin of Columbia University. His textbooks are definitive on this, and I might point out, hugely accessible. He is a former governor of the Federal Reserve System. Rick Mishkin, I want to go to chapter 16 of one of your books. I think it's the 47th edition. I can't remember, where it's simple. You talk about fiscal policy and government budget. How far removed will that be for Chair Yellen from the everyday of the Federal Reserve?
Well, the Federal Reserve is not supposed to focus on the budget directly because that's not in their remit. But clearly, it's very important in terms of the ability for monetary policy to do its job. And also, particularly in the environment we're in now, where interest rates are near zero and monetary policy is less effective as a result, fiscal policy really comes to the forefront. Janet understands this very, very well, that she's said the right things, which are as follows, which is that there really is a need for fiscal expansion right now. There's also, very importantly, a need for cooperation between the Federal Reserve and the Treasury. You couldn't get it better than Janet interacting with Jay Powell, so that's very good. But also, very importantly, which unfortunately our politicians are not doing enough, Janet has emphasized that although right now we need very expansionary fiscal policy, we have to worry about the long-run budget balance. And that's something that really neither the Republicans or the Democrats have done. But Janet gets it. She's really a terrific person for this job. I couldn't think of a better choice for this position right now.
Professor Mishkin, we've gone from Jacob Lew, who I'm going to call a grizzled political wonk out of Massachusetts, to Mr. Mnuchin, who I'm going to call a Wall Street Hollywood type, with Mr. Trump. And now we go to a hardcore academic, something you'd be familiar with. Are we de-Wall-Streeting the job? Are we moving Treasury away from Wall Street?
In this case, I think that's true. But I think the real issue is getting somebody who's competent. It's perfectly reasonable to have a Wall Street person in Treasury if they're really good at understanding policy. That's not always the case. But one of the things that's key about Janet, she's not just an academic. This is somebody who's been involved in policy work for a very, very long time. Yes, she was an academic for quite a while. I met Janet when she was an assistant professor at Harvard well over 40 years ago. We became friends then. So Janet has been in the trenches in almost all the key policy jobs, that she was a governor of the Federal Reserve, that she was also then a president of the Federal Reserve Bank in San Francisco, which is when I interacted with her quite a bit because I was a governor at the time and we used to meet periodically, actually, before every FOMC meeting, we'd always have a meeting, either at lunch or dinner together. And also, she was a chairperson of the Council of Economic Advisors. She really understands policy. She's been involved in that world now, very, very seriously at the top levels for 20 years. And she knows her stuff. And she's also not a partisan type person. Jen and I have some different political views, that she's to the left of where I am. But actually, on economics, we really never had any big disagreements. She does the analysis carefully and thinks really hard about it and is super well prepared. And that's exactly what we need right now. Clearly, one of the things that's critical right now is to calm everything down, to get some straight thinking on what to do about the coronavirus pandemic and also how we can support the economy during this next period of the next 6 months or so. And Janet is extremely highly qualified to do that.
The focus right now, Rick, is on how closely she'll work with the Federal Reserve. And quite clearly, everyone says very closely. For you, how close is too close?
So too close is when the Treasury tries to dictate to the Federal Reserve and interfere with its independence. Janet very much appreciates the independence of the Federal Reserve, will be strongly supportive of it. And so in that sense, there's no issue at all. Having strong cooperation, it's always been true, by the way, that the Federal Reserve Chair and the Treasury Secretary meet periodically. I think they always had a breakfast. I can't remember how often it was, but I think at least once a month, or maybe once a month, they would have a breakfast together. That's actually critical because monetary and fiscal policy do interact. On the other hand, what you don't want is where the Federal Reserve independence is challenged. Now, that's not going to happen under a Biden administration. Trump was really awful on this, that his criticisms of Jay were just brutal. you know, mean, call him loco, saying Jay's an idiot and so forth. That's done. Biden understands what was done during the Obama administration, but also before that, that the Fed works best and the economy works best when the Fed is independent of day-to-day interference by the politicians. That will continue. Janet is somebody who strongly believes in the independence of the Fed. She's not somebody who tried to dictate to Jay Powell. Instead, what you'll have is cooperation, which is exactly what's needed.
Although you'd have to say, Rick, in the back end of 2018, the president might have had a point when it came to judging and feeling out the market a little bit. We can put that to one side and maybe touch on that another day. Well, I want to talk about policymaking with you.
Look,
I had a feeling you'd want to jump in. Go on, Rick, please. Yeah. Please, go on.
Yeah, you could be right that I actually advocated easier policy during this period than the Fed was pursuing. But the issue is not the policy. It's the issue of interference, which then can actually cause problems. So pushing the Federal Reserve to do expansionary policy can lead to a rise in inflation expectations, which would be very damaging. So the way you talk, it's not just what you do, but the way you talk and the pressure you put can actually be very damaging. And in fact, most presidents before Trump, particularly since the Clinton administration, have understood that it's, including George W. Bush, understood that leaving the Fed alone actually helps promote a good, strong economy. But that doesn't mean that the Fed is always right. They do make mistakes. And with a crystal ball, we could always do better. But the key point is let them do their job. They've got a job to do. There are technical people to do it. Janet fully understands that.
Rick, when it comes to making policy at the Federal Reserve, those decisions are grounded in economics. When it comes to making policy in the Treasury, it's economics and it's politics too. And I just wonder, Rick, when you start to think about trade, if you have a position on trade in the Federal Reserve, is your position on trade exactly the same when you are running the Treasury?
I think Janet certainly is going to be pro free trade in an appropriate way. And particularly, very important is if somebody's not playing by the rules, you want to be able to deal with them, but you don't then abuse your allies in that process. So if you really want to deal effectively with China, you don't slap crazy tariffs on the Europeans, which is what's been done under Trump. And this has been very damaging to our ability to actually get a more even-handed trading situation that will be beneficial to the U.S. and particularly with China. So I don't think that the positions... It's very true that Treasury position is much more political, and so you have to deal with those issues. But on the other hand, almost all economists, by the way, very few, and those were the few that worked in the Trump administration, very few think that trying to close down our borders is a good idea. Janet is very much in the mainstream on that. I think it'll be very helpful in crafting a much better trade policy under the Biden administration.
Meanwhile, Rick, on a domestic level, there is a question of how she is willing to run the economy hot in tandem with the Federal Reserve, perhaps giving ammunition from the Treasury. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, are you surprised that the market hasn't priced in a higher, longer-term inflation rate on the heels of Janet Yellen's selection, based on what we know and based on her comments?
So I think the answer is they haven't, and I think there's good reasons not to. Janet's very, very good on this. I had a lot of interaction with Janet when I was a governor at the Federal Reserve. Both of us were strong advocates of controlling inflation and inflation targeting, and Janet gets that. The key issue is that right now we're in a very different environment. It's actually a remarkable environment for somebody who's been a professor for now over 40 years and a monetary economist, which is the big problem of central banks is not that inflation is too high, it's too low. And so at this particular environment, it makes sense to pursue expansionary policy, both monetary and fiscal. There is a time when that could change. And in fact, having a very strong commitment to keeping inflation under control is important. I think that the Federal Reserve has moved to a procedure of so-called average inflation targeting, which could be beneficial, but has not been articulated in a way that I think is as helpful as needs to be. To make sure that the commitment is as strong as ever. But Janet has always had a very strong commitment to controlling inflation. There's no doubt about that. Her statements, her policies, when she was chair of the Communications Committee at the Federal Reserve when I was there. So the issue here is not that they should worry about too high inflation, but we do want inflation to get back up to 2%. And Janet understands that, and Jay Powell understands that. So that's why I don't think the markets need to be afraid of Janet on this.
Rick, come back soon. Always great to catch up, sir. Frederick Mishkin there, the former Federal Reserve Board Governor. Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
I break a cardinal rule. I have a cardinal rule that I never talk about a book until it's released. I break that now. Cass Sunstein is at Harvard Law. You know I loved his book, Impeachment, which never once mentioned Donald Trump. There is too much information. And yes, he writes for Bloomberg Opinion. But there will be a book next year. It's already must read and it's not even written. The book is Noise, with a gentleman from Princeton, Mr. Kahneman, 70-inch Cass Sunstein. Cass, wonderful to hear about this book of 2021. How are we going to get ourselves away from what we here at Surveillance struggle with every day, our addiction to the noise? How are we going to do that?
Okay, well, let's make a distinction, shall we, between noise like high volume, lots of stuff. How do you sort it out? The book that is out, Too Much Information, is really about that.
Yes.
The book Noise is about signal versus noise, meaning there's just so much variability. So if doctors are asked, do you have COVID-19? One doctor will say yes. Another doctor will say, I don't think so. If you ask one grader whether the paper gets an A, the grader will say yes. And another will say, no, it's a B minus. That's the kind of noise that we're worried about. And it's a source of pervasive unfairness in the criminal justice system, in the welfare system, with permits and licenses. It's also a source of really high costs for companies when two people who are supposed to make the same decision, one says yes, the other says definitely no.
But Cass, so much of this is about the strange word from another time in religion called grace. And that grace is about uncertainty and understanding that we live within uncertainty. Anyone, those that agree with Mr. Trump and disagree with Mr. Trump, would say he majored in certitude. He knew what he was talking about. How do we escape our certitudes that are wrapped around too much information and our certitudes of noise?
Well, there's a great judge with a crazy name, a Learned Hand. Was this a prank by his parents who named him Learned? But he kind of fulfilled the prophecy of learnedness and learned a lot. And Learned Hand said this during World War II, the spirit of liberty is that spirit which is not too sure that it is right. And that's kind of perfect, because you can be sure that you're right, as, you know, Democrats and Republicans often are, but they're sure. But things go sour if they're too sure that they're right. So there should always be a voice in a democratic society saying, you know what, the people who might consider the other side, they might be right. And if that voice you let in your head, you become calmer, nicer, and that savage part of the human spirit kind of dissipates.
This makes sense. And at the same time, you're walking a fine line as we sort of infringe on the idea of freedom of speech and freedom of decision making. And I think that there probably would be a large swath of the nation that would say, this is the problem, that academia, which tends to be more liberal, wants to weed out things that's wrong and not necessarily let people think their own thoughts. And this is really brought to the fore with Twitter and Facebook's recent filters on President Trump's tweets, as well as other information that's been disseminated. How do you walk this line? How do you create a filter that is fair and gives the impression of fairness to people looking for independence and freedom?
It's a great question. So let's think of three different categories. One category, which my Too Much Information book, that's not a very likely title for a book, by the way. I'm not sure that's a best-selling title. But the idea behind Too Much Information is, first, the government's taking too much information from us. So it is imposing 11 billion annual hours and paperwork requirements on the American people. It may be nurses, it may be doctors, it might be patients, it might be people who want to build things, and they are being hammered by paperwork requirements. requirements. This is especially bad in a period of COVID-19. So that's not a free speech issue. It's an issue of imposing burdens, which are often like walls between the American people and things that they have a right to. The second thing is disclosure of information that's mandatory. So if you get a medicine, it might have 7 pages of side effects information, which you'll never read. Or if you get a mortgage, you might be drowning in stuff. Or if you buy a product at the grocery store, there might be a ton of things there which are so complicated in terms of information mandates that you're not going to benefit. So information mandates is a second thing, which is often excessive and often kind of clueless, and that is not a free speech issue. Then there's a third thing, which is, you know, Twitter and Facebook having warnings and disclosures as part of their product. That's actually technically not a free speech issue. In fact, technically not, because Twitter and Facebook aren't governed by the First Amendment because they're not government. And that's how our Constitution was set up. Mm-hmm. And itself a big positive in terms of freedom, that a private social media outlet doesn't have to worry about the things the government has to worry about. Now, having said that, there are free speech issues in the non-technical sense that it's completely fair to discuss that private actors often raise.
Cass Sunstein, thank you so much. Just can't say enough about too much information, and to come next year with Professor Kahneman of Princeton Noyce as well. Cass Sunstein at Harvard, Harvard Law. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.